The first case we have this morning is 21-1414 Doe versus Board of Regents. Would counsel for appellant make the appearance and begin, please?
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael McHale on behalf of appellants, and with me today is Peter Breen, co-counsel. May it please the court, and just as a preliminary, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal if possible.
If possible is the operative phrase. Go ahead, please.
Right. In August of last year, the University of Colorado Anschutz School of Medicine adopted a religious exemption policy to its COVID-19 vaccine mandate that violated the First Amendment in a manner rarely seen in modern times. The policy limited religious exemptions solely to those who possess, quote, a religious belief whose teachings are opposed to all immunizations. In other words, if you belong to a religion, you were out of luck. That policy doubly violated the First Amendment's clearest command against denominational discrimination and its promise that, presumptively, the state may not restrict practices because of their religious nature. And the defendant university officials applied this policy pervasively and perniciously, and all 17 plaintiffs were denied accommodations under the September 1st policy.
And that's the policy that I thought you were talking about, and that policy has been rescinded, hasn't it?
So it's the plaintiff's position is that the September 24th policy, looking at the evidence in its totality, is effectively applying the September 1st policy. So formally, yes, the university on September 24th updated its policy and made the new criteria whether one could perform remote work entirely. But looking at the evidence in its totality, it's clear that there's at least a slight suspicion that what's really happening is a continued distrust of plaintiffs' religious opposition to COVID vaccines. So, and that's why...
Looking at the record in its totality, well, what is it in the record that is concrete in the September 24th policy that would lead you to believe that it's implicitly applying the September 1st? That's the first question, and I'll let you answer that, and then I'll move on.
Right, it's the way it's being applied primarily. So three of these plaintiffs work entirely off campus and were on their way to or actually received religious accommodations from those facilities, and yet they're told by the university that they're an undue burden or an undue hardship, that they're a danger somehow to these facilities that wanted them. But what really that gives rise to the inference that what's really going on is they just have the wrong religious belief. It doesn't make sense that they're excluded by the university. Also, the disconnect.
That they're forced to work remotely, is that what you're saying?
The plaintiffs who are healthcare providers and were on their way to or received accommodations from the facilities they worked at to do in-person work, even. Also, the disconnect between the defendant's policy and the State Board of Health's policy. So the defendants say they enacted their policy in view of the State Board of Health, but the State Board of Health allowed religious accommodations in person from the beginning, and then in December actually encouraged them by allowing religious accommodations at facilities to count towards a vaccine rate. So that disconnect there.
Just to be clear, this encounter took place under the September 24 policy. Is that right?
Could you repeat the question?
This encounter you're talking about occurred under the September 24 policy, not under the first policy. Is that correct?
I'm not sure that's correct, Your Honor.
You ought to know which one. Just tell us.
All 17 plaintiffs were denied accommodations under
the September 24. Was it after September 24?
Initially, no. All 17 were denied.
No, this encounter that you described, was it after September 24?
I'm not sure what encounter you're referring to, Your Honor.
You said they were on their way to work and told that they couldn't come.
Right. Jane Doe 1, for example, worked 60 miles away at Children's Hospital, and she was on her way to an accommodation. Her supervisor said that she was
I understand that fact. I'm just asking a simple question. You could easily answer just yes or no and then move on. Did that encounter occur before or after September 24? It's not a hard question.
You were discussing the one related to Jane Doe number one, right?
The one you
your
example that you were presenting to the court. I just want to know when it happened.
Right. Jane Doe 1 was before September 24th, but then she was later told after September 24th that she would be an undue burden. And Jane Doe 11, similarly, was actually granted an accommodation by her facility more than 100 miles away from campus. And then she was told after September 24th that she would be an undue burden. But when there's that kind of over-inclusivity, and Lukumi, the Supreme Court was clear in Lukumi, when there's this over-inclusivity, when it's clear that the burden on religion isn't actually necessary to achieve the government's interests, that gives rise to an inference of religious animus or religious non-neutrality. So here, Jane Doe 11, taking her example, she actually received an accommodation from the place she worked at, and yet she's still fired. But clearly, her facility didn't view her as a danger. So that's the kind of over-inclusivity that gives rise to an inference of here, even just religious distrust. And the Supreme Court standard is even a slight suspicion raises the bar and requires heightened scrutiny. That's because of, go ahead.
There was something you said when I initially spoke about the September 1st policy, though, that raises a question for me. If the notion is that somehow they're implicitly applying some of the constraints of the September 1st policy through their implementation of the September 24th policy, it still doesn't answer the question for me that I had in my mind of why we can't just deal with the September 24th policy, because there it goes towards the application of this policy. It is being applied in an unconstitutional way. My point being, the September 1st policy, it seems to me, is dead and gone. I mean, I don't understand, even if your argument is that the sort of the spirit of it lives in the September 24th, or the application of the September 24th policy, well, why don't we just strike down the September 24th policy? Wouldn't that give you what you want?
So as to the mootness issue, it doesn't necessarily, as to Jane Doe 2 and Jane Doe 9, at the very least, because they were not reevaluated. But even if you're right, I would say absolutely. The September 1st policy still informs the neutrality analysis of the September 24th.
Well, it may, but it doesn't mean that September 1st policy still has vitality in terms of a vehicle for relief. In other words, if you're saying that the September 24th policy, they are sort of implementing sub salientio, the September 1st policy, through that, well, why wouldn't it give you full relief to strike down or to enjoin the September 24th policy in all its permutations?
Well, it's just a basic application of the court's Rezac opinion. But
no, and well, why is that? I mean, the point is, it's one thing to say Rezac talked about lingering effects of, and number one, there were only one policy at play in Rezac, not two, lingering effects of that policy. Well, if you're saying that the lingering effects of the policy are at work through the implementation of the September 24th policy, why can't we just deal with the September 24th policy?
Even if we're wrong about that, Your Honor, absolutely, an injunction against the September 24th policy would provide significant relief here because of this disconnect, these issues I'm raising about the manifest religious distrust that seems to be, at least gives rise to the suspicion that triggers strict scrutiny. And another key is that the September 24th policy is non-neutral even on its face with its explicit bar on religious exemptions for students. An accommodation request by a student turns entirely on the religious character of that request. But that's what the Supreme Court in Trinity Lutheran and Espinoza and lately in Carson, when the government's burdening someone because of their religious character, that triggers strict scrutiny. Also, that is another vestige that tethers the September 24th policy to the distrust that initially occurred.
That led to the implementation of the September 1st policy. Go ahead, please.
Just looking underneath the language is required in free exercise analysis under Lukumi to survey meticulously the facts and circumstances that led to. So even if the September 1st policy as a formal matter is gone, yes, and even if you're correct about that, the September 1st policy is still a key part of the history. And then they also applied the September 1st policy in October. So after September 24th, supposedly everything had changed. But they told Jane Doe 1 in briefing in response to our motion for for a preliminary injunction, that the reason she was still ineligible, or a reason, is because surely she must be aware as a bioethicist that drugs like Tylenol and aspirin are connected to abortion. Also, at the same place, they compared, contrasted her views to the Vatican's official teaching office. This is under the September 24th policy, allegedly. There's a continuity that just continued, and that gives rise to at least the suspicion that triggers strict scrutiny.
For better or worse, I'm going to allow a little liberality here on the time. And so let me just ask one question, because I want to make sure I know the answer to this related to RISAC. Let's assume for the moment that I want to understand why RISAC would not be just limited to the prison context. I mean, the cases that it cited were prison cases. And what struck me in RISAC is the prisoners had very little ability to change their circumstances. In other words, you know, the lingering effects idea, I'm still not an ADX. Well, and shouldn't that solve the problem, but I'm in another facility. Well, it was very difficult for them to avail themselves of some mechanism to get out from under that. It seems to me that constraint is not necessarily at play here. I just want your response to that and we can move on.
My immediate thought is, as to students, the students are completely restricted now from even applying. So they're under a kind of constraint that they can't get out from under.
But that's 24th policy, right?
It's 24th policy. Right. It's a 20, but it's the lingering effects issue, that there's a lingering effect there insofar as students are completely bound and unable categorically to apply. So giving them some type of process, at least, to seek accommodation on equal terms with employees and students who can seek medical exceptions, another sign of the disparity there. That would be fitting, I think, within RESAC still. That's my thought. But
okay.
Yeah. So much, there's just manifest and overwhelming evidence. Another key piece of evidence is illogical and shifting explanation by the university for the September 24th policy. So they said that the reason they needed it was because of an increase in COVID in September of last year, but yet Chancellor Elliman in his declaration said they had granted zero religious exemptions under the September 1st policy, and they've only acknowledged granting two medical exceptions. So it's not clear what needed to change and become more restrictive. But then before this court, Chancellor Elliman, in a supplemental declaration at the IPA stage, said the reason they changed the September 1st policy was because it's vulnerable to litigation. So which is it? An increase in COVID, even though they hadn't granted any religious accommodations from the September 1st, or vulnerable to litigation? This kind of shifting justification when there's an ongoing religious burden, and a lot of healthcare professionals are completely terminated from providing healthcare, even though they were granted some of them. Granted accommodations at their satellite facilities, gives rise to the suspicion that what's actually happening is not an undue health hardship or anything, but a distrust of their religious beliefs, and that distrust was manifest.
Let me ask you a question. It was my understanding that from your briefing that your view is that medical exemptions are comparable secular activity to religious exemptions. Is that right?
That's right.
Well, isn't there a distinction in that medical exemptions in the current shortage of medical personnel serves to facilitate treatment at the facilities? I mean, whereas the religious exemptions are not similarly situated, are they?
Religious, I'm not sure I agree, because religious exemptions for healthcare workers to continue providing treatment would seem to serve the same interest. I would say. Also, Carolyn Brownwell, the associate vice chancellor, made it very clear that
the numbers are different, though, aren't they? In terms of people affected,
total exams.
Yes.
So the First Amendment, Justice Gorsuch made this clear in his Dr. A dissent, which was an emergency appeal denial. So it was a non-merits denial by the Supreme Court. Gorsuch. So his point was that the First Amendment requires a one-to-one analysis when you look at the general applicability analysis. So it's each plaintiff as compared to another single plaintiff. And then you can take the numbers into consideration at the strict scrutiny stage. And that seems to make sense. Also, the district court said that the numbers game somehow tilted against students here because students could outnumber the amount of employees who seek exemptions, and that would create the numbers disparity. But obviously, the employee number far outweighs the student number at the university. But regardless, I'd go back to the one-to-one analysis that's required. And the university has been clear that it's being unvaccinated and the possibility of spreading COVID, that's the harm they're trying to get at here. And a medical exemptee undermines that interest to the same extent on a one-to-one basis as a religious exemptee. And the September 24th policy just by itself is also not generally applicable, and this is important. They allow, taking that policy exclusively by itself, students and employees to work alongside the unvaccinated at satellite, at affiliate and non-affiliate sites. So they allow the same kinds of harms working alongside the unvaccinated that they say these plaintiffs pose. That's the exact kind of harm under canon.
Did you raise the question of not sufficiently inclusive, that is under responsive to the problem in your briefs? I didn't pick that up as an emphasis argument of yours. That's a discrete, separate argument. And you argued that it was insufficient, and that is a reason for what? What conclusion should we draw from the fact that this is insufficient to cover the entire problem? I mean, almost every piece of legislation that's ever been passed doesn't 100% solve problems. We deal in the practical and the pragmatic, and not the perfect. So I'm kind of at a loss to understand, number one, whether you really are asserting under-inclusiveness in your briefs consistently, and secondly, why is that such a terrible problem here?
We did assert at four different levels of under-inclusivity, but in particular, the fact that the defendants allow their employees and students to work with the unvaccinated at affiliate and even non-affiliate sites, which poses the same type of risk to their interests. That's the language in Tannen. If it could pose the same type of risk, that triggers scrutiny. And the difference there with the other types of legislation, Your Honor, is this is First Amendment religious exercise. There's an ongoing substantial burden, and the First Amendment has a special solicitude in that situation. So we look with heightened scrutiny at under-inclusivity in a way we don't necessarily do.
I see your time has expired, but that answers my question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Dr. Jacqueline Rich Frederick, Special Assistant Attorney General. Along with my co-counsel, I represent the University of Colorado Board of Regents and other defendants in this matter. The University of Colorado's medical campus, as well as its employees and students, have provided vital health care services to the most ill and at-need Coloradans. This essential role was particularly acute during the 30-plus months in which the COVID-19 pandemic has ravaged Colorado, sickening more than 1.6 million people and claiming nearly 14,000 lives. The fall of 2021 was a particularly challenging time. In response to rapidly increasing case counts, the university promulgated its September 1st COVID-19 vaccine policy. 3 weeks later, that policy was repealed and replaced with the September 24th policy. The policy requires all employees and students of the university to take one of then three available vaccinations. Plaintiffs here are unlikely to succeed on the merits of their challenge because the university's September 24th policy survives the Smith rational basis test for two reasons. First, the policy's purpose is rationally related to a legitimate governmental interest. In short, the goal is to save lives. Second, the policy is both neutral and generally applicable. No CU employee or student who is unvaccinated may come to the medical school campus or have contact with patients. Because plaintiffs have not met their burden to show that they are substantially likely to succeed on the merits, the district court correctly denied their motion seeking preliminary injunctive relief.
When you say it's neutral, the one clause that gives me pause in the September 24 policy is the phrase, religious accommodations are not currently available to students or applicants. Was there a similar statement for medical or other kinds of accommodations also not being available to students and applicants?
No, Your Honor, because medical exemptions are available to students. The only exceptions available under the policy are for all people, medical exemptions, for employees, Title VII compliant religious exemptions.
So, as I understand your argument, the reason that I guess that you acknowledge that religious prohibitions are distinctive. They're, religious people are being singled out, but you are justifying it because Title VII allows that for students and applicants. Is that the summary of your argument?
Your Honor, as to the distinction between the treatment of students and employees, students are not granted religious accommodation under Title VII. It doesn't provide for that. The university's policy is designed to provide all of the required exemptions while maximizing their trio of goals, which include individual and public health, i.e. to safeguard patient, employee, and student life safety.
Well, counsel, why would a distinction between students and employees further that goal?
It would further both that goal as well as the two additional goals, which are to limit transmission of the highly transmissible virus.
I take those as a given. Let's just take those goals. Those are a given. Why does your policy, which does not let students apply for religious exemptions, serve those goals?
It serves those goals because it maximizes the number of vaccinated persons on the campus.
Is that it? It just keeps students from coming on campus. There's no distinction, actually, between students and medical providers other than the numbers. It's just getting rid of numbers.
Your Honor, it is both numerical as well as tethered to the fundamental distinction between a medical and a religious exemption. So yes, as I believe the court discussed with opposing counsel, the record does reflect that the university received more than 200 religious exemption requests. Comparatively, it received only 79 medical exemption requests, of which only 11 were granted. It is true that it is—
But is there a distinction between students and medical providers, other than numbers? In their risks or their whatever else that they present?
As human beings know, as to their job duties or potential interactions with the campus, yes.
Okay.
Medical students at the medical campus have as part of their core training obligations to participate in clinicals. That places them in a situation where in order to progress through their education, they have to be able to have those on-campus, in-person interactions through those clinical experiences. That is analogous to, for example, Jane Doe's 1, 10, and 11, who have at the heart of their obligations, core duties, to provide care, for example, as Jane Doe 1 does, to critically ill infants in the NICU. That is dissimilar from, for example, plaintiffs such as Doe's 4, 5, 6, and 7, all of whom were able to be successfully accommodated because their core job duties could be performed either off campus or remote on campus. And so it is both in furtherance of what Biden versus Missouri recognized as the opposite of efficient and effective administration, as well as for the numerical purpose that the court has recognized here today.
The school had no remote learning opportunities for students during the height of COVID?
The school did work towards remote opportunities during COVID. However, students are required to complete in-person clinical rotations as a core part of their curriculum. There is a difference between, for example, a student who is at the end of their program of study and may have only coursework left. That can be addressed remotely. Clinical experiences, the treatment of patients, must occur in the clinical setting. And for that reason, John Doe's 6 and 8 could not be accommodated because they were brand new students pursuing a medical certification as well as an anesthesiology credential. And each of those require them to be in intimate contact during their clinical rotations with patients.
Well, but the line that's drawn is employees and students. There are surely some employees that are also in intimate contact with patients, and they nevertheless may seek a religious exemption. Is that not right?
They may seek an exemption congruent with Title VII, and the university accepts at face value, though it could inquire under the law, the sincerity of their belief under the September 24th policy, and then turns to an analysis of whether they can be accommodated without undue hardship to the institution. Through that analysis, the university has successfully accommodated 7 of 13 employee plaintiffs, more than half.
Oh, that's more than half. That's a good thing. Then why doesn't the university try to do that with students? I mean, if this is a numbers game, this goes back to the fact that we're talking about individual constitutional rights and burdening an individual constitutional right so that you can, in the aggregate, reduce the number of people on campus who have potential for COVID. I'm not sure the Constitution contemplates that. And if so, give me the best case you have that says it does. Numbers game.
I would say Biden versus Missouri's recognition that the inclusion of a medical exemption to avoid sickening employees and students allergic to the vaccine demonstrates consistency with the university's goals in this case. I would also point the court to Hochul out of the Second Circuit, which dealt with a policy that had in place likewise exemptions for employees, not for students, and which the Supreme Court declined to overturn.
Well, that doesn't tell us anything. As you know, if the Supreme Court did, if you're saying the Supreme Court denied cert, I mean, that doesn't tell us anything. And so as it relates to the students, then what is the difference between a student getting a medical exemption and a student getting a religious exemption that doesn't have to do with the numbers?
At the end of the day, Your Honor, the university is consistent that no person who is unvaccinated may be on campus engaging with, in particular, patient care, regardless of whether the exemption that they seek is medical or religious in nature.
I thought you said you accommodated 7 people who were employees who were able to interact with patients. Let me reframe it. You're telling me that there are no employees now who are interacting with patients who are under exemptions?
Who are unvaccinated. That is accurate, Your Honor.
All right. And so in terms of students, if those students have a medical exemption, they are not permitted to interact with patients?
Correct.
And under what circumstance is that possible? What's the nature of an exemption if they can't interact with patients?
If they are able to be exempted from the requirement because taking the vaccine would cause them to themselves be ill, contrary to the university's public health goals and the maintenance of hospital staffing levels, then the analysis turns upon whether they can be accommodated in a manner that does not present an undue hardship to the institution. If they would be required, in order to complete their studies as a student in this case, to interact with patients, they could not do so safely without imposing undue hardship upon the institution because it would impose life safety risk to the critically ill patient.
Well, this filter of doing an undue hardship analysis, that's not even permitted to students who are seeking religious exemptions. I mean, they don't even get in the game, right? They blanket or prohibit it.
They are not eligible for a religious exemption under the September 24th policy. That is correct. However, the case law
I have two further questions also on this religious accommodation. The word applicants, what does applicants refer to? Is it applicants to be students or applicants for employment?
I cannot say with certainty, Your Honor, without the policy in front of me, what it is modifying in that particular sentence, but I anticipate that it would be student applicants if it is addressing ability to access religious exemption, all applicants as it addresses medical exemptees.
So you're thinking, I mean, will we find the answer to that question in the record someplace? This doesn't relate to job applicants, but only student applicants?
I would commend to the court the affidavits, declarations of Chancellor Elliman, and that addresses as well as, and that's going to be Exhibit E. There would also be relevant information in Exhibits B and C, which are the attestations of those who precisely undertook the analyses for both medical exemptees as well as religious requests for exemption. which addresses the fact that they are treated likewise.
So your position is that you think the record will support that applicants refers to people that are applying to be students. Is that correct?
That is what I would anticipate, Your Honor.
All right. Then the second question
I'm sorry. That's not a yes, though. Are you taking a position or you're not?
I'm not sure where in the policy the word applicants with a specific question is with regard to which particular part of the policy in which the word applicant appears.
It's the sentence we've been focusing on the entire morning. Religious accommodations are not currently available to students or applicants.
That would refer to expressly students, current students, or applicants for student status. That does not include employees.
Okay, then my second question is, we're familiar with the concept of severability in statutes. If there's something unconstitutional in a statute, we ask, is it severable or isn't it? That's a question that has to be decided. I'm not familiar with the application of that concept for the policies of private people like the university that is non-statutory. But could, if we found that sentence questionable or unconstitutional, could that be severed from the policy, or would that require the entire policy to be stricken?
I think it could be severed. I do not believe that it is unconstitutional, Your Honor.
That wasn't my question, though. But is it the university's position that it could be severed from the policy and the rest of the policy kept in place, or would it be that it's part of the policy, and if that part is unconstitutional, the whole policy falls?
I do not believe the whole policy falls, Your Honor. The policy is consistent in aggregate with or without that single sentence, in that it extends required medical exemptions to both employees and students and provides the opportunity for religious exemption congruent with Title VII to all employees. It is
Thank you. That answers. I don't want you to run up the last bit of your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Courts have consistently applied the rational basis test and found that vaccine policies support legitimate governmental interests. That's Doe and Mills, Hochul, Claussen, Children's Defense versus Rutgers, Atunas versus UVA, Bush versus Fantasia, and Valdez, a District of New Mexico case, which an iteration of this court affirmed the denial of a motion seeking preliminary injunction and cited favorably language from the district court in that case stating that stemming the spread of COVID is a compelling governmental interest. The Supreme Court has gone further and observed that curbing the spread of COVID-19 is unquestionably a compelling interest. That's Roman Catholic Diocese. An unquestionably compelling interest is inherently legitimate. For that reason, the university's policy is a legitimate governmental exercise which passes rational basis. It is also generally applicable and neutral.
Well, on the neutrality point, what about the argument that we've heard this morning and in the briefs about, I don't know, the word animus was not used, but citing Lukumi, the notion that there is this, at a minimum, negative reaction by the university to those who seek to exercise their religious rights as opposed to others. How does that, and as these play out in terms of the individual does and they're seeking accommodations, that is the inference that the opposing counsel draws. Were that to be in fact what we see in the record, that's a game changer, right? I mean, that alters the analysis of how we go about looking at this, because it's not a facially neutral policy in which we're trying to discern burden, but it's one in which you're, as in Lukumi, targeting religion, right?
If there was animus, yes, it would alter the analysis. There is not animus in this instance. The policy of September 24th is facially neutral. It requires all employees and students to take the vaccine. It is also neutral in that it was not put in place to discriminate. The object of the policy is consistent to further public health, maintain staffing levels, and save patient lives. That is non-discriminatory. The policy was expressly amended in furtherance of those goals in light of rising case counts and to ensure non-discriminatory application of the policy itself as attested to by Chancellor Elliman.
Let me understand one thing about the amendment from adopting the September 24th policy. When you adopted that, what was the university's express approach to the September 1st policy? In other words, did it declare it to be null and void, one, and essentially disclaim the terms of that policy? And how is that framed? Because, I mean, part of this argument about mootness is the ghost lives on of the September 1 policy. Well, part of that ghost would live on, arguably, if the university was essentially allowed it to float out there. You know, we've got a new policy, but we're not saying that anything in that other policy was wrong or problematic or that we won't do it again. What is in the record that speaks to what the university's policy is vis-a-vis the September 1st policy now that it's adopted the September 24th?
The answer to the court's first two questions are yes and yes. This is not a haunting, Your Honor. The September 24th policy is a repeal and replacement. Chancellor Elliman's declaration states that explicitly. Declarations B and C likewise clarify that a new group of individuals was brought in to assess application of the new policy as it regards evaluation for religious exemptions. Under the September 24th policy, and has been consistently done now for more than a year, the university foregoes inquiry, though permitted by law to do so, into the sincerity of someone's faith, which moves promptly to the second prong. As soon as someone has asserted that they have a belief, the university takes it at face value, making no further inquiry, and instead considers if the core job duties can be accommodated without an undue hardship.
Counsel, can I just stop you there? So you're telling us that there was no inquiry into the sincerity of the belief, none, zero. Once September 24th happened, there was nothing.
That is correct, Your Honor, and the record reflects the same. All currently employed individuals were reevaluated under the September 24th policy, which led to 7 of the 13 employee plaintiffs being accommodated.
But you concede that there was, you looked into the sincerity of the beliefs before September 24th.
Under the September 21st policy, as permitted by the law, the university did ask, is the belief sincere? The university is no longer engaged in that inquiry, though the law does permit them to do so.
Under the September 24th policy?
Under the September 24th policy, they do not make that inquiry.
Okay.
But why? I'm sorry. So you made it before, and you're not making it now. What was the justification for that?
Ultimately, the September 1st policy, which is moot, was drafted to be congruent with Colorado State Statute 254901, which is the school vaccine statute. There was an additional inclusion of the word all, which created a bit of an inartful implementation of that policy. And as such, and as reflected by Chancellor Elliman, the university rescinded, they repealed and replaced that policy with a September 24th policy to make explicitly clear that both in policy and practice, the university welcomed employees to seek a religious exemption and takes them at their word as it regards their sincerely held faith beliefs, and simply inquires into whether the job duties may be accommodated without undue hardship.
You continue to take the position, I'm sorry to keep pushing on this, but you take the position that it would be fine to inquire into the sincerity of the beliefs. It's just, you've chosen not to.
The law allows that inquiry.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, I wanted to return, Judge Holmes, briefly. You had asked about Lakumi, and I wanted to address that expressly. We are not in that same space. In that instance, the policy at issue was promulgated after the Church of Santeria indicated that they intended to open a facility in Hialeah. Promptly thereafter, the city promulgated this policy and included express language that was both connotatively and denotatively religious in making restrictions, focusing upon ritual and sacrifice. Not so with the September 24th policy. CU does not target religious conduct for distinctive treatment. in a manner that does not advance its governmental interest. It does not advance its governmental interest only against those with a religious motivation.
I am finding this argument incredibly interesting, but given my generosity, I think it's going to have to come to a conclusion soon, because I'm going to give counsel a little bit of rebuttal time. So if there's anything remaining that you're burning to tell me, tell the court, then tell us. Otherwise, please conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. You've been very gracious. Because the university's September 24th policy furthers the university's legitimate governmental interests and is both neutral and generally applicable, it readily passes the Smith rational basis review. Therefore, the university respectfully requests that this court affirm the district court's denial of the first preliminary injunction as moot, and likewise affirm the district court's denial of the second preliminary injunction for want of failure to satisfy the four-part test predicate to the issuance of the extraordinary relief that plaintiffs seek. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go with 3 minutes. And it will be a hard 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the government can take into consideration sincerity, but it cannot consider legitimacy. As Masterpiece Cake Shop said, the government may not presume the illegitimacy of one's religious beliefs, but that's exactly what happened under the September 1st policy. And looking at the evidence in its totality, and I'd point you to the New Hope Family Services decision in the Second Circuit, which had undertook a similar analysis. There it was a motion to dismiss stage, but the court reversed a grant motion to dismiss, and the district court then applied the same analysis to grant a preliminary injunction of finding non-neutrality based on the facts and circumstances. Also, failure to disavow. So the government here still fails to disavow the express presumptive illegitimacy they undertook under the September 1st policy. So Masterpiece Cake Shop said the commission, civil rights commissioners, failure to disavow, and even the government's arguments in their briefs, failure to disavow their initial overt discrimination was evidence of suspicion that there was something more afoot here than just Jack Phillips' supposed discrimination. There was a hostility towards his religion, and even distrust triggers the heightened scrutiny.
And so we're talking Lukumi in framing this argument,
correct?
Right? Okay.
Correct. Also, I'd say Masterpiece. Also, in Axe and Flynn, this court's decision in Axe and Flynn, there was a neutral rule. You've got to adhere to the script. And the Mormon student said, I do not want to take God's name in vain. I don't want to say some cuss words, not all cuss words, but some. And this court, granted, it was summary judgment stage, but it said that that's evidence that raises concern and requires an analysis of whether there's something more than the stated interests. And we have here, it can't be overstated how important the initial September 1st policy is to the analysis. The discrimination was overt. This is an extremely unique case. They put the discrimination in writing, and then they applied it perniciously. They sent out this mass August 26 email, impersonal, by the vaccine verify, anonymous, no one knows who they are. There was no accountability. You only had 5 days to comply, no opportunity to appeal. They told John Doe 1 that the university had discovered some unrelated Buddhist university that allegedly had inconsistent beliefs with his Buddhist beliefs. Jane Doe 1, they said, we sincerely hope you reconsider your beliefs. That's in Masterpiece Cake Shop and in Axe and Flynn. The government officials expressly wanted the individuals to reevaluate their values or compromise on their values. That was evidence of something more than just a neutral policy. We had that in spades here. Also, the idea that they accommodated the remote workers. Title VII, just by analogy, says you can't even segregate employees in a way that would even tend to deprive them of employment opportunities based on their religion. So the remote employees here are seeking more than that, but just also, those employees were already put in remote positions under the September 1st policy. Chancellor Ellman said that some work was rendered remote under the September 1st policy for business continuity purposes, and it would be for the foreseeable future. Nothing changed, and certainly the in-person care employees are similarly situated to the in-person work that the university already allows at affiliate and non-affiliate sites. So we ask this court to reverse the district court and remand with instructions to grant a preliminary injunction.
Thank you for the fine arguments. Case is submitted.